questions that could reveal your purpose in life? What if there were questions that could surface the change most meaningful to you? And what if answering those questions would give you the power to ignite? Welcome to the Illumify Game Changer podcast. These are big conversations that lead to self-discovery. Together, let's embark on the leader's journey and ignite meaningful change. When leaders speak about their meaningful change, it has to be of interest to those listening. If not, they'll tune out, and it can be difficult, if not impossible, to get them to tune back in. In this episode, Jonathan considers whether his vision is of interest to those he sees could help him realize it. But could it be they're too preoccupied just now to even have it on their radar?
What interests them? What interests them? What matters to them at this moment? What draws their attention? Are they preoccupied with something? Distracted? Is this change even on their radar? If I think of all the people we've talked about in that previous conversation, so the people who would find this meaningful and who would want to help, starting with family and friends, but then moving beyond that, I think there are so many things preoccupying them. Certainly not distraction. Certainly not the people I was talking about. I'm much more drawn to the word preoccupation here. Are they preoccupied with something? That speaks to me here. What I see and feel across all the people we've talked about so far this morning, I think is a deep, deep sense of worry. About where we are right now. In Europe, if we talk about geography, Europe, and within the European Union, because of what feels like a very, very difficult moment in Ukraine's war of resistance against Russia. I think deep concerns about the ability of our political systems to respond to the challenges we face at the moment. I want to bring back in the word fractured, because it became very, very important in our previous conversation, and I think really, really is at the heart of the vision and what the vision is trying to repair in some way, what it's responding to, you know, our fractured selves. I certainly, amongst the people I know best, a real deep sense of a sense of worry around, you know, whether we are even sharing a factual reality together anymore. Whether we
nice.
Are whether we are experiencing the world together. And that really becomes a problem. That's when we start to lose our bearings even more, when we start to lose it.
How does living in falsehood as a collective, a global society, influence values? Is that how they eroded in the first place?
If I'm thinking of the people I know here, and going back to the group of people who would care, and would, I believe, would want to help ignite this change. people who would find it meaningful to themselves and their lives, that group of people. I think we're looking at a group of people who have grown up with the idea of a shared reality. So I'm speaking now to something which has been lost, a sense of loss.
Because of the falsification, the distortion.
I think it's about how we experience the world. It's about how we experience the world day by day, minute by minute. I'm not talking here about divisions through politics, cultural divisions. That those are all important. That they are part, a big part of our current malaise, for sure. I think there's a layer beneath this that goes a little bit deeper, and is just about how we experience the world day to day. Because if we don't feel that we are sharing the same world, then where are we? Where are we?
What a huge question.
And where do we go?
Where are we? That's frightening.
Now, the stock answer to this, the easy answer to this, and it's important, it's true, but it only, I still think it's a bit superficial, is the screen, yeah? Our addiction to the screen, the people who have made astronomical amounts of money through not just our addiction to the screen, but the human, our human weaknesses. This brings us back to loneliness. Yeah, this is where it starts. We all have a deep, deep need for privacy. And this is much more than just occasionally retreating from the world back to our houses and our homes so that we can take a break and recharge. It's much more than that. It's the place where we need to retreat to and take refuge in every day at some point.
Without intrusion?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Without intrusion. And we have created a monster in our city, willingly, where it is right that we direct much of our anger, I think, at the companies. We know who they are, the big companies who have made vast amounts of money out of people's intimate lives, out of the encouragement of anger, the as a way of communication. We know this, yeah. The whole way of organizing digital communication and the algorithms that are at the heart of the machine, which have celebrated and encouraged anger. But even as I say this, I realize how it's not the heart of the problem. What Shoshana Zuboff says in her brilliant book, Surveillance Capitalism, is she goes back to the beginning of this, and that's where I'm going to now, the loneliness of our condition, where we felt we needed these tools to reconnect us. And the question was, it was the right question, what could be more important than how we connect? What could be more important than how we communicate with everybody, family, friends, but also strangers in other parts of the world? It's this is really important. But she speaks in her book of a loneliness as the starting point, that the social media was at best. You know, I don't want to be completely negative here, because I know there is always another side. There is always another side to every story, and I'm sure somebody could present me with compelling research, both statistical and qualitative, demonstrating how social media has, in fact, connected people. So I'm not denying that. But for me here, the key point is the loneliness that is the starting point. So why do I mention this now? What interests these people? What matters to them at this moment? At the most urgent level, it's the future of our democracy, whether there is a future for democracy. Ukraine's struggle to defend itself. These are all big, big, urgent issues which are critical, not just for the future of a continent, but for the future of democracy. I have no doubt about that. I don't think that's at all in any way an exaggeration of what's at stake. And yet there is a deeper level here. What are we preoccupied with? And I can't get away from this idea of a fragmented public space.
Yeah,
we all go back to our homes, and what we do of an evening, wherever we live in the West, yeah, I'm confining myself again to the West, may not have changed so dramatically over the last 20, 30 years. Food around a table, a kitchen table. Maybe some TV, maybe some games, maybe just talking, maybe reading a book, maybe going out back into the city in the evening. That part of life, you know, the rhythms of life still feel very familiar to me. Something else has changed that we're struggling to put our finger on. And what we reach for is what I was just talking about. So the anger and the distrust, which have been massively encouraged and enabled and celebrated in some way online, in our online world. But what I'm trying to get to here is this, and it's more difficult to put your finger on it, but this sense that we're losing the sense that we share a common public space, yeah. A public space, a shared public space where we don't agree on what needs to be done. We don't agree on our priorities. We don't agree on who to vote for. We disagree on so many things. That's not the point. What worries me now, and I think what worries the people that I'm thinking of here, what preoccupies them, and I know this through long conversations over many years, is the beginning of a sense that we're losing hold of a common shared sense of what is actually happening. And that leads to a sense of the uncanny. You know, if we're trying to get back to this idea of what does it mean to be untethered, dislocated, not at home anymore, not feeling at home anymore, even as we go back to the same physical house or apartment each day, if we're lucky to have one. And that's what I'm trying to get at here. And this is a real, these are not, let me be clear, these are not in the people I know. You know, I was joking earlier that we spent our whole lives talking about politics. It's not the only thing we do. But it's not an academic or philosophical concern. It really is a deep worry about the day-to-day fiber, yeah? This is about the fiber of the life that we have together as a society. What's in the air? What's in the air? There is a... And also, I'm seeing the... My brain is seeing the complaints coming in almost in the courtroom. But a common complaint here is, well, it's a time of upheaval. It's a time of change. It's normal that people are feeling unsettled. After all, we've had the financial crisis and then the pandemic. We had Trump in 2016. Now we have the war in Ukraine. You know, come on, there's no mystery here. This is not what I'm trying to get at. These things are all big, urgent and worrying in their own way, and in their own way signal a crisis in our society. and not just a geopolitical crisis, but a moral crisis. But again, this is not what I'm trying to get at. Because if I'm trying to link this question here, what interests these people who are going to help me? What interests the people who see my change, my meaningful change, as meaningful to them?
Exactly.
That's what I'm sensing. This deeper concern about just the world that we share. So not the privacy of our homes, but what we share as we walk out into the street. And you get. I feel both. I feel hope at times. I just want to mention this because it's a tiny thing, but important. I arrived at Union Station in Toronto yesterday. The day before, 2 days ago. Took the train from the airport to Union Station here in Toronto. I'm looking around Union Station so I can get to the subway, which is in a different. You have to sort of leave the building. You should go down some stairs. And a young woman stopped me. She just stopped me. Said, "Are you lost? Can I help?" You know, I wasn't holding a map. She'd been attentive enough to see that I was lost. And she stopped with a smile and just said, can I help? Now, why am I saying this? Because in my world, that would happen regularly. But it's not happening in my world. Whether that's Copenhagen or Brussels or wherever I've been over the last 5 to 10 years at many times, this is rare. And it's speaking to something here. And again, this is the stock answer is, okay, public levels of civility and trust. And I'm digging for something deeper here. I think there's something else. It's eye contact. I remember we had a really good conversation about eye contact in London. The importance of eye contact, the fundamental importance of eye contact.
As connection.
Yeah. That's, you know, there's something missing there.
Could it be, Jonathan, that she recognized on some level that you were not at home?
She must have done. She must have done. There could have been many clues. It could have been the clothes I was wearing or one of the bags that I was carrying. There were clues. There may have been clues that said, this guy's not from here. He needs extra help. He's probably come from the airport. Fine. That's all good. But the ability to stop like that, and she didn't carry on. She stopped. She stopped, rooted her feet, turned to me and looked and smiled. And it was a very frank question, you know, can I help? And it was just wonderful. It was the simplest thing, but just wonderful. And the reason I'm mentioning this is, yes, we all have a list of the ordinary acts of everyday kindness. Really important. It's always been there. I hope it will always be there. The reason I'm mentioning it now is it just feels to be of a piece with the wider question of what we're sharing or not sharing in our cities at the level of the street when we leave our house in the morning. Mm-hmm. And which cannot only be explained by social media.
Yeah, I want to go to a number of places here, but let's start with this woman planting her feet in front of you and making, with a warm embrace, making contact, rooting herself enough to pause her life at that moment. Because I want to extend from her to, given she literally posed the question, can I help? Now imagine if you're that metaphorical collective that you can reach, who hears your vision and responds with, can I help? So in a way, she is symbolic of that because could it be likely that she herself had had the experience of being in a different place.
Quite possibly.
And not knowing which way to go.
Yes.
She may have just wanted to be on a podcast.
Oh, you cynic.
But she offered. That is what I call, as we get to unify, an offer to you.
Yes.
You didn't make a request of her. You didn't stop her and say, can you tell me where the subway is?
Nope.
She stepped up and saw whatever she saw in you. Yes, maybe your clothes, maybe your state, maybe whatever, your hesitancy even. And she made an offer from a place of certainty herself on, you know, that was her home. Mm-hmm. She was familiar with it. It wasn't unknown to her. And I can tell you, had you arrived in Union Station even a year ago, it was such chaos. It took, I don't know, 5 years for them to renovate that massive building. And it was a series of blocked, you know, corridors. No one, even living in Toronto their whole lives, would have known where to go. So she saw you and she proffered to you something that would help you feel more at home, navigate from there to where you needed to be next.
Yeah, that's right.
I have a question. What she offered was palatable enough, appealing enough to accept. Yes?
It felt very welcome. I was genuinely lovely. Lost. I mean, I would have found my way, but you know what it's like in these situations.
Yeah.
It really matters. It really helps.
So if she had instead said to you, excuse me, would you like me to show you where home is? Would that have been received as openly? Help me with that.
Taking you to where you're going.
It would have confirmed that David Lynch is just everywhere and he's writing the script for all of us in every
time.
City. Yeah, yeah, they would confirm that. It could have quickly become a great David Lynch moment.
You
sure.
Didn't want her to go home with you, did you?
No.
Be home. If someone went up to all of the homeless people right now, all the symbolically as well as every expression of homeless being on the planet and said, I can take you home. I know where it is. Mm. I know where the place is that you've been seeking.
Yeah.
What would happen?
You mentioned the offer. You mentioned the offer, Marianne. That's the first thing. And in some ways, the most important thing, that offer. This is going to curl my toes.
That's great.
I'm going to have to really work hard through this.
Curl your toes. I love that.
I'm saying this because it's true, okay?
Yes.
It's going to sound...
And there's truth in the words,
and I'm asking
Jonathan.
Because I genuinely haven't a clue what the answer is. Yeah. So I'm
no,
really looking
No, we have a great English word. Do you say corny in Canada?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Not so much anymore, but
right.
Yes.
Yeah. Same in England. I think we use it a lot less, but it's a great word. It's a great word. This is going to sound sort of corny, but I have to say it because for a few seconds, I did feel it yesterday, and this is maybe the feelings of... This was probably 2 or 3 minutes before I meet this young woman. Mm. So I'm not quite on the concourse of Union. I'm still down on the platform. Got off the subway, and I'm going to walk into Union Station. And this is probably triggered by the advert that was inside the train. There was a small poster, I think, on the inside of the train that had caught my attention, giving the number of people in GTC.
GTA, Greater GTA. Toronto Area.
That's right. Yeah.
GTA. Or GTR, right. Greater Toronto Region.
I think it was GTA, I think. And giving a very precise number of people, of young people who are homeless.
On the train. From the airport.
It was either, to cover my bases here, I either saw this poster in, because I can see the guy's face.
Wow.
On the poster. It was either in the train itself coming from the airport to Union or somewhere in Pearson itself, the airport. I think it was in the train. Pretty sure it was in the train. So this had triggered something.
Yeah.
So there's a moment going on there. So
good.
David Lynch is definitely writing the script. Although this isn't a David Lynch film. This is more of a Ken Loach film.
Or a Jonathan Hill film.
Well, and okay. So I'd been triggered by this. And I think the number was 40,000, 50,000. It was a big number. It was a big number, yeah? An arresting number. I remember, while we're here, you'll sympathise, I think, I hope, Marianne. I quibbled with the language a bit. I said, why are you writing 40,000 or 100, you know, experience homelessness? Two long words.
Yeah, yeah.
Just sleep on the street. Don't have a home. Yeah. Make it simple.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And visual.
And visual.
Experience homelessness. Experience what homelessness. Does that look like?
It's like, oof, long words. Yeah. It's like
fire the writer.
Yeah. Come on, guys. You know, live on the street. Don't have a home. Go to bed without a whatever. Just, I don't know, make it more real. Anyway.
Yeah.
Leave that aside. I'm not saying I could do better.
But but you know, that's the comment back to language. Every time I hear a police officer, a commander typically, speak to some tragedy, they never use the word died or dead. They use euphemisms for it because it becomes more palatable. Mm. So same thing.
Yes. Yeah. 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 So back to the corny moment. I'm triggered. I'm probably getting the first feelings of that, the weirdness of arriving in a city on a sort of cool, not cold, but a cool December afternoon. And I've seen this poster. And I'm just walking along the platform. And it's just a daydream moment. There's no planning or thinking. This idea just pops into my head. I said, what if I just spent a day? What if I spent a day or a year just talking to the homeless? So not offering a home or food, although you could. But what if you just spent time and talked with them for a day or a year, whatever? It's not a vision of change.
Would that be enough for you, Jonathan? I'm not denigrating it in any way, but would that be enough for you?
Yeah, at that moment, and I think that's why it came, at that moment it felt, yeah, what could be more than that? What could be more than that? You know, what could be... What could mean more? So right in that moment, it did feel enough.
A number of years ago, maybe 10 years ago now, there was a young girl in one of our prairie provinces in the middle of Canada, in a city called Winnipeg. Shout out to Winnipeg, because it's a very active community. And this young girl started speaking to the homeless. Not only speaking to them and asking their names, but she did something that became what was called the Ladybug Campaign. My memory of the details is shady, but as I recall, she gave them some sort of ladybug. Felt ladybug or something, and I stand to be corrected on that. But what was so central to what she did was that she was seeing them, she was recognizing them, and treating them as people, not just a faceless body on the street. And they would speak back to her and thank her for speaking to them. And that was of enough significance that that young girl at age 8 was flown to Toronto to speak at one of our business forums, the Empire Club, to all of these business leaders, CEO types, I remember being in that room and hearing her. And it was with view on her part, not to put words in her mouth, but to build awareness of the fact that these people were invisible, already invisible within her city. And they could not, we could not, any of us afford to allow them to be invisible, that there had to be some change. Mm. Back to normalizing. It had become normalized in her city that this happened, this existed. So in her way, as an eight-year-old, the first step was to talk to them and to then speak about them, to put a face on them for others who were in a position to act. She ignited some level of change. And change and what you ignite, as I hope is clear, is at the level of which is meaningful in the way that is most significant and meaningful to you.
Yes. Those final words there right at the end, in the way that is meaningful to you, that's the key, isn't it? Because I hasten to add, as we say, I hasten to add that we had a brief conversation during the break off the record. We had a brief conversation about a very clear sense in my own mind that my vision comes from a place of fragility, hope and uncertainty about values and hope about the future. But also a place of fragility and a sense of shame. And there is shame here, the healthy shame that leads to action, where I know, if I go back to my family and friends, I know my sister, one of my two sisters, back in Nottingham, has regularly stopped people on the street and asked if she can help, has spoken to the homeless, hasn't waited for anything, but has gone to a homeless person and said, can I help? Can I get you something? Can I buy you some food? She's done this with her boyfriend. And multiply that. There are thousands of people in the UK and across Europe who are doing this every day. I think the reason I'm mentioning it, A, because it happened to me 48 hours ago as I arrived in Toronto, and it was part of the arrival and coming here in that feeling when you're in a place you've never been to before. And even navigating a railway station can feel difficult. So that was top of mind. But also I do think I'm trying to dig down to this deeper sense of homelessness that people are feeling, even if they do have a home. So I mentioned it for that reason.
Mm-hmm. And Jonathan, speaking to the homeless can absolutely be one of the ways of expressing your vision and reaching, igniting the change. Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree. I think you're right about that.
I'm aware of the fact that your vision is of a shared home.
Mm. Yep, that's the first line, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. A shared home.
Yeah.
And again, that doesn't preclude you from expressing the complete loss of a home and what that means, being uprooted, being homeless individually. Absolutely not. Or being in a home individually and still not having a shared home. There's so many tangents of this that are all related. But if what you see is that shared home, that makes your vision quite distinct. That means elevating at some point to the shared.
And that's where I feel, it's where I feel the warmth of the idea that it's not conceptual. Warm because it comes from a place of feeling and experience and concern and shame. The shame of inaction, the shame of paralysis so far. Anger. The anger at the normalization of this, that we have all together. I'm equally guilty.
And to whatever degree we are all homeless, whether individually or because your words, when you spoke of your friends and family members, the shared interest there, that they're preoccupied with a fragmented, the fact that, that we have a fragmented public space, public, shared.
Yes, exactly. Exactly that. And where, if I follow on from that, where our, the danger here is that our refuge in our private home, vital though that is, becomes a little bit too important. I remember Liz and I, my partner, Liz and I arriving in Copenhagen and having this shared sense of needing a refuge at that particular moment in our lives during the pandemic. The fatigue and weariness of 25 years in Brussels, in my case, a pretty harsh burnout for Liz in her case from professional life, and the need to, hide away.
Restore.
Yeah. Restore, repair.
Repair, rejuvenate.
But
reconcile.
Also, yes, but also hide away a little bit.
Hide away.
You know, I say
retreat.
That with no shame.
Absolutely, because until we can step back.
Yeah.
And refortify ourselves.
Yeah.
What condition are you in to continue?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So that the risk here is that we lose the will to step back out into.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So the shared home, if we come back to the vision, the shared home is, it's also the home that we share out there, in the street, in the city centre.
In the world.
In the world, and the world, yeah. Absolutely, absolutely.
I also want to underline that the question is what interests them. So when you think of the word interests, just let me pose that to you. What are you interested in?
Let me give you the quick answer because it's the image right in my head right now.
Yeah.
Books.
Okay.
A lot of the people I'm seeing here as this conversation goes on, and I can hear their voices in my head.
They're readers.
Readers in my book group.
Okay. Yeah. So think of that response, books, as your interest.
Yes.
Typically, an interest is more of a positive thing. I like reading books, for example.
Yeah, it's deep
passion. So the question is what interests them first. That's the predominant gold question here. And you went immediately to what worries them, what concerns them.
Yeah.
Which is the flip side of that coin, which is in itself quite revealing, is it not?
Yes.
They're more preoccupied with what concerns and worries them than what is of satisfaction, fulfillment, etc. To them.
Yeah.
Enjoyment even.
Yeah.
And is that the state we're in?
If you spend a big part of your life talking about politics and not the party politics, but what's actually happening out there, what's actually happening out in the street, it's natural to spend a lot of time feeling worried and preoccupied. Interests, you know, what interests them, coming back to the big question at the top of the card, what interests them, what matters to them at this moment? To me, this feels like a moment where what is at stake is just too big not to be preoccupied with. I can say with a high degree of confidence that the people I'm thinking of right now, that first circle of very, very close, intimate friends and family, so the people who would help in that first instance, feel this as well. And that's probably why I said I was drawn to the word preoccupied.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, card. For good reason.
Are they preoccupied? I think it does feel overwhelming to these people at the moment.
So when you identify things like that, this is all with view to expressing what will reach them, what they'll hear.
Yes.
And then from, and there are more questions to come before then, but when we get to what you actually say to them, you look at, so what is the, I'll say strategic intent.
That's fine, yeah.
Okay. So it may be they first, before they can even begin to embrace your vision enough to start to act on it, they need to be reassured that it's even possible. Because now, even though they're preoccupied with it, their hope is gone.
Mm.
They can't see beyond what is now.
Mm. Yeah, I think this is where I need to do the work, the digging, the lifting necessary to reach over this first inner circle.
Yes.
And go to the next group.
Good, good, good. Okay.
Because if I look at that first inner circle, the family, the close friends, the intimate friends, where you share more than interests. Yeah, you share more than interests, but a common view of the world. Mm-hmm. Because you spend so much time together.
And you've talked, had many conversations. And talked. Yeah.
Yes, yes. There will never be a shortage of hope amongst those friends.
Okay.
Vis-a-vis you and your vision, there wouldn't be a need for reassurance there.
Okay, good to see that.
But if I hear what you're saying now, Marianne, then if we're looking at the next circle beyond that, then yes. What matters to these people at this moment? What draws their attention? And let me jump to the final line, which is the most provocative line and the most difficult question, I think, on the card. Is this change even on their radar?
Right.
Is this change even on their radar?
Is it of interest to them? Do they, quote, care, unquote?
Mm.
Care enough to act? Or are they just reconciled to it? Or is it invisible? Is it even on their radar? So what's radar? What do they see?
Mm.
What's incoming, what's around them.
Yeah.
If it's not even on their radar, they're oblivious to it, no matter how much it's even affecting them. So if you have any expectation that those people will help you ignite, how realistic is that? Does it have to be on their radar at some level?
I think the deeper sense of unease, this goes back to what I was saying, I think, in the previous conversation. I cannot accept within myself that these feelings I have are peculiar to me. The exotic feelings of a nomad who has chosen an unusual path to leave home once, twice. I can't believe that my sense of homelessness and uprootedness is confined to me. I don't believe that. So I have to start with the idea that my vision would resonate at some level that would break through the immediate day-to-day concerns.
And that's the key. Right there, that's the key. You can. There's something about you that allows you to do that.
I mean, this is what I'm seeing on the card. Is this change even on their radar? I'm not sure I can know that myself.
Okay.
But I have to have faith in the ability of the vision to not so much catch attention. That's further down the line, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's at the moment of communication. So it's not so much catch attention, grab attention, but in some way resonate, touch a nerve.
Touch a nerve.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So even if it's not on their radar now, and I don't know what the radius, if that's the word, of radar is, if there's no awareness, really it maps to no awareness. They can be suffering from something, be completely unaware because it's now become a normalized state for them. The fracture, for example.
Yeah.
And now you're saying, huh, doesn't have to be that way. Now, if they can hear you, and that's a bit, again, what your job is, if it matters that they hear you, if they can hear you, then suddenly it can suddenly emerge on the radar. Mm. A glimmer, a little, you know, flash, perhaps. So as Catherine says, you have the unique ability. You're right that being a nomad is not particular or peculiar, as you said, to you. We're in a world where the migrant, quote, migrant refugee crisis is paramount everywhere, increasingly. And just from a very microscopic point of view, I am someone who I once calculated that by the age of 18, I'd lived in 13 different places. Not of my own volition, because I was, instead of an army brat, I was a corporate brat. My father moved around a lot. We moved homes a lot. Did that make me a nomad? I never really felt that way, but there are different degrees of it. There are those who, like you, you've chosen to be a nomad. It's been of your own volition. That is exceptional to most nomads out there, or those homeless out there who, as you said, have been forced out of their home, whatever that home may be. So when you answer this card, is this change going to interest them? Is it of interest to them? Is it?
I think if there is truth in the vision, it will reach some people. Mm-hmm. It will resonate. Mm-hmm. Because it will have come from We talked earlier about insight, discovering something not through imagination or creativity, but insight, something that you yourself have already absorbed.
Can we put a capital on that? Capital I, insight.
Yeah.
Because it's so significant, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Because I think that's part of, it's not the whole answer to this question, but it's part of the answer to this. What matters to them at this moment? What draws their attention? Well, what I'm feeling here is that if the vision has come from a place, from a moment or a long, it's not one moment, but a long process of insight, then it must contain some truth that will resonate with other people that I don't know yet. I have to have faith in that.
Yes, of course. Yeah. And you do, don't you?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
People you don't even know.
It's the power of art, isn't it? At some level, it's the power of any art. Music, the music that moves me most today still, it's where you hear something created by somebody on another part of the planet in another country, and they've put together a collection of, they've put together a sequence of notes and chords and melodies and arranged it in such a way that when it arrives at you and enters through your ears, you are profoundly moved and overwhelmed by something, mm-hmm. a common feeling, which is mediated by the mysteries of music. But what really matters is what's behind that. This is not to diminish the music anyway. The music is beautiful and powerful and mysterious. But ultimately what matters is that the two humans, hitherto separated by distance and history, culture, have suddenly in an instant been brought together.
Connected.
Deeply, deeply connected. And this is the best answer I can give for now, I think, to this question on the card. Is this change even on their radar? No, except when suddenly it appears on their radar.
Right.
At that moment.
Maybe not yet, but doesn't mean it won't.
I
have a question. It's just sitting there. I don't know how to.
Yeah.
How does a homeless person, conceptually speaking, help another homeless person not be homeless?
Mm.
How does that work?
Through through simple recognition to begin with, in the very, very first instance, recognition. Again, as you said, Marianne, being seen, being talked to in that first instance, being seen, being talked to. But then being seen and being talked to, and then just staying together for a moment, however long that moment is. Because if you sit beside somebody for a period and don't move, but just sit and continue to sit, then what's happening? As you sit together in the same spot, and as that becomes 5 minutes, 10 minutes.
In a shared space.
Right. And you do that for a day, and then maybe you come back and you do it the next day. Starts to become a habit.
What happens to the disconnection within them and between you and the loneliness?
Yeah. It's the beginning of a response, isn't it? Mm-hmm. A very, very, very simple human response. Mm-hmm. The beginning of familiarity, even in the most difficult circumstances, even in the most lonely circumstances. The first sense of familiarity.
Belonging.
Belonging, yeah.
It's quite the start of a movement.
I want to bring up an old reference just before we leave this question, because it's just emerged. Mm. I was raised Catholic. And at some point, and I, you know, in my youth, the Mass was Latin, full of incense. Relate to that, Sean? Maybe not. You're too young. But, you know, I mean, there was always a separation of the priests from the congregation, literally elevated, right? And at some point, I don't know, Vatican II, I don't know, beyond Vatican II, but maybe the 70s, the church implemented a practice, which probably still stands today, where at a certain point in the Mass, you turned to the person beside you.
Oh, how I hated
that. I knew you would. The person in front of you, the person behind you. So either side, front and back, and wish them, offer them this. May peace be with you. You didn't like that, did you, Catherine?
Do you know what happened when you looked into the eyes of the people who were saying that? They weren't saying the same things with their mouth as they were with their eyes.
No, they weren't. And you could see the falseness of it. Yeah. And it's forced connection is what it is. It's forced connection based on a shared background of Catholicism. And it's telling to me that the people who put that forced connection in place are standing, still standing, elevated on an altar above them. So true connection, even when it begins with a glimmer of seeing, really seeing. Seeing what, we spoke of this yesterday, what people don't necessarily want to be seen, the loneliness, the fracturing, the homelessness. Thanks, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Jonathan's vision of a shared home is distinct. There may be no one else in the world who sees it the way he does. But he also sees that even those closest to him, his inner circle, are preoccupied right now. It's not even on their radar. They therefore don't see it as a possibility or maybe even as necessary. Jonathan knows that something has changed. As he puts it, we're losing that we share a common sense of what's happening, and that worries him. He has faith, though, that his vision, coming from a long process of insight, contains truth that will resonate with others, even those he doesn't know yet. And he already has an inkling of where to start to help ignite interest in his vision. It all comes down to restoring connection. The leader's journey continues. Stay tuned. If listening to this Illumify Game Changer podcast is of value to you, please like it on this platform and share it with those who could ignite meaningful change. It's here, as am I, to be of service. I'm Marianne Gobet. Thank you for accompanying us on the leader's journey. To fully experience the passage to igniting meaningful change, subscribe to the Illumify Game Changer podcast. To learn more about the Illumify Game Changer and how to embark on your own leader's journey, please visit Illumify's website at illumifyinstitute.com. You matter. Step up. Speak up. Together, let's ignite meaningful change.